All of old, nothing else ever. Ever tried, ever failed, no matter. Try again, fail better. Samuel Beckett. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank you all for joining me this week. If you're a newcomer, welcome. And if you're a returning listener, thank you as always. Please feel free to go back and peruse our backlog of episodes. I do want to apologize for getting this out a little late. My travel plans changed rather last minute. They decided to just keep our office closed all this week, so I went ahead and came home. And I brought most of my stuff I needed to record, but there was a couple of small technical issues I was trying to deal with, so apologies for that. But on the plus side, that means I should have an episode out regularly next week. This week, though, we will be talking about the development and advancement of more settled agricultural peoples in the Zagros/Western Iranian Plateau between 6 and 4,000 BC. Before we dive into that, though, I did want to go over a couple of points that I either forgot to make or wanted to put a kind of finer point on. First, I forgot to mention the rise of copper artifacts. The metal's use begins to be implemented more and more over the course of this season, and not just among settled peoples in the Zagros, where you may remember from last season, the earliest copper beads were worked into a shape, and they were found in this region. And it's beginning to become more common all over, and I have tried to make mention of copper when I find them, but I wanted to make clear that nomadic groups are using copper artifacts too, and they're probably making their own. Now, this is probably goes against the common understanding of technological advancement. Typically, new inventions are associated with settled societies, but before 10,000 BC, it's important to remember that all human invention was come up with by nomads. And remember also that the methods used to work copper at this time were very simplistic and really not that different from working certain types of stone. Cold rolling, annealing, which is where you just heat the metal enough or the stone enough to make it a little bit easier to mold or to shape. You're not melting it, but you're getting it hot so you can kind of work on it that way. Now, as time goes on, of course, more sophisticated or mass-produced works required new techniques and technology. And this is something that typically emerged in settled groups because they were able to support more specialized labor if they were successful. Pastoralists could do this too, but again, usually not as many people able to do that work. And this leads me into my second point, the finer point I wanted to make. That is the distinction between nomadic and settled peoples. And this is something that does become much more stratified. But at these earlier dates, that isn't necessarily the case. We talk about these material cultures and divide them regionally and how they are living. And in a lot of cases, these are accurate. However, in cases of very closely neighboring groups, we sometimes overlook the possibility that the distinction between settled and mobile groups is just a modern one. They may have been the same people ethnically and or linguistically speaking, and they were just trying to survive in a way that suited them best or in a way that served their immediate and extended families' best interests. And I can fall into this way of thinking quite easily, because in my case, when it comes to history, my primary focus is conflict between different people and peoples and places. And while I am trying to be a little bit more broad-minded and cast a wider gaze in this show, I sometimes fail at that, or at least I don't make things clear. But I am going to, of course, keep trying to improve, though. Now, in terms of the same peoples practicing different lifestyle modes, we have historical examples of this. It's not just something that in history is generally taught or distinguished to the broader public or more casual listeners because, well, you only have like a limited amount of time in the classroom, and it's just easier to just paint things in a more black or white, A or B, one or two type scenario. But this is all stuff we're going to cover a little bit more later. For now, though, let's move on to the primary focus of this week's episode, which will conclude our direct focus on, well, probably, well, no, I should maybe hold off on that. I think there will be a return to some of these groups a little bit next week, but this is going to be kind of finishing off the majority of it. Now, last week and last season, we talked about the first sites where evidence of the Neolithic toolkit and agriculture show up in this region. Sites like Donjdara, Ali Kosh, and others. Now, these weren't contemporary with the earliest settled sites of Anatolia, like Göbekli Tepe, or the other Taz Tepler sites, or Çatalhöyük, or of Jericho, and the sites of Syria and the upper Euphrates River Valley. But they were next, in, or they were in that next wave of sites to embrace that mode of life. And while they didn't last as long as those others, their impact on spreading agriculture and the Neolithic toolkit and pottery was important. Not to mention them starting to use copper in the region, and possibly being responsible, or partly responsible, for kicking off the Copper Age in the Middle East. The decline of those sites led to much more dispersed, smaller settlements, mostly spread out along the Karka River and its swamplands in the south and east, and the Dez and other tributaries of the Karun River. Now, the Karun River is Iran's second longest and only navigable river, though technically I think the portion of the Aras that flows through Iran is much smaller than the Karun River, so some people see it as Iran's longest. It doesn't really matter. The name Karun is believed to be a corruption of the Kurang River, and where the Kurang meets the Beheshtabad River is the start of the Karun. Now, I could not find an etymological guess or breakdown of the Kurang. Early classical sources refer to it as the Pasa Tigris, and this meant something like the Little Tigris or the Tigris Minor. Now, the Karun does or did flow into the Tigris in the past. Now it meets the combined Tigris and Euphrates, the Shat al-Arab. Of course, all these have shifted course many times over the years, including both in the prehistoric and historic periods. Now, the agricultural sites that emerged in the Zagros after the collapse of the last group are focused either along these river systems or in and around the Iranian-Anatolian-Caucasian border region. The southern sites along the river and marshes relied more on said water sources for water for their crops and animals. The sites in the northern border regions still get, you know, a little bit of rain, but they also had runoff from the mountains. There's Lake Urmia in the north, and though not nearly as much, you know, the water they're getting via runoff is not as much as the other regions further south. Now, none of these sites, north or south, reach the same size as the earlier round of Neolithic sites, but there are more of them. The current round of sites are also firmly part of the Pottery Neolithic. And remember, prior to this, Western Iran was part of the pre-Pottery Neolithic a little bit longer than the people in Mesopotamia. Now, some of the older sites were occupied as well, but none became as large as they had previously, until much later. There also appears to have been large-scale cultural change, or maybe the people living in said places were not related to the first inhabitants of said places. One example of this is the site of Ali Kosh. And the first settlement phase there, which was between about 7,500 to 7,000 BC, had larger single room houses, mud thatch, you know, and they had stone foundations with the dead buried under them. They also practiced several types of body modification, like cranial deformation, and the ritual removal of the same tooth from everyone's jaw. And, you know, this is something that people might remember, skull deformation, evidence of a connection, you know, to maybe early Ubaid peoples. Well, it's possible, though, again, many people practice skull deformation. Now, about 500 years before the start of our season, Ali Kosh had been reoccupied, so about 6,500. The homes were smaller and made mostly of stone. The dead were buried outside the town proper, and I didn't see any mention of the dead that had been found having evidence of body modification. This period at Ali Kosh is called the Muhammad Jafar phase. Though it is abandoned, of course, by the start of this season, similar sites are found close by with fairly similar configurations of homes and pottery and artifacts. Now, the Muhammad Jafar sites last until about 5600 BC, give or take a century or so. And it is also around this time that the sites around the river systems were starting to grow and expand. These sites are typically associated with the Susian period, or Susian material culture. The name comes from the type site of Susa, and the English name Susa is derived from the ancient Greek Sosa, which ironically came from the Susa in the Achaemenid Persian version of Elamite, which, of course, descended from the Middle Elamite name for the city, which was Susun, which was derived from the original Elamite name, which was written as Susin. Now, the modern city of Shus is very close by. In fact, it seems like the epicenter of the city just kind of moves a few kilometers away from where it had been previously over time. And Susa will become one of the primary cities and capitals of the Elamite civilization. However, around 5600 BC, and this period's referred to as Susian A, it actually, the Susian culture was actually not centered in Susa. Susa would not be founded until after this period has kind of ended. The first evidence of the material culture was found, it starts a little bit further east at a site along the Dez River called Chugamish, or Kogamish, depending on the way you see, depending on the source, it may be spelled slightly different. And it was around 25 kilometers east of where Susa was going to be founded. And it has evidence of small-scale occupation dating back to around 7,000 BC. But starting around 6,000 to 5,800 BC is when Chugamish kind of enters its own. In addition to a number of smaller buildings, a larger kind of singular structure was constructed kind of towards the center of the settlement at a high point. And they developed their own pottery, though they do appear to be trying to copy the way the Ubaid culture did their pottery. They kind of like that style. They love beveled bowls. I think they found almost 2 million pieces of different beveled bowls. Though, of course, as time goes on, they develop their own style. It's more unique. It's got their own flair. But there is a lot of influence of Ubaidian, kind of this early phase of Ubaidian urbanization. They have a lot of the same features, though some of it appears to have been homegrown. They have kind of have their own ideas. But there is definitely contact between them and their other kind of contemporaneous Mesopotamian neighbors. And the Susians were very clearly trade partners. There's definitely artifacts from Iran, or not necessarily artifacts, but material that came from Iran in the Ubaidian and then later Uruk-ian periods. The Susians also developed kilns around the same time as the Mesopotamian cultures, but in fact, the oldest kilns found appear to possibly predate the Mesopotamians, so it's possible they developed kilns and spread it the other way, or it's possible, again, that they were just kind of mutually invented around the same time. Another type of product that they created, at least apparently on their own, were bulle. And these were clay tokens wrapped in larger balls of clay, clay balls, clay cones, clay discs. And then when they needed to extract the token, they would destroy this kind of outer layer and get the token inside. And these tokens would probably represent an amount of a product or a foodstuff, something along those lines. And this is kind of a very early form of record keeping. You see several people use a similar concept. I don't think, or at least I didn't see anything mentioned about stamp seals being used at Shogamish until the very end of this season. Primarily, they were using bulle on their own, and that's B-U-L-L-A-E. Now, Uruk sites used both as well, though they didn't use bulle until next season, at least as far as I remember. So it is possible that bulle were used initially in this region, and then they also adopted the stamp seal just as a kind of a backup or a secondary system. But that's a theory. Some people think that, you know, this is also an invention that moved the other way. So that is debated. It's also possible, again, that both groups created a similar system around the same time. And also, the stamp seals were being used in Uruk at this period. So it's possible that, you know, they traded the bulle for the stamp seals, at least in terms of ideas. They probably wouldn't trade them directly with each other because everyone has their own for internal use. And again, stamp seals, I think, had been used at Hassuna and Samarra as well. So it's possible that the Hassuna or Samarra peoples had transferred knowledge of stamp seals to the Susian and Uruk sites. It's one of those big confounding mysteries and back and forths in kind of archaeology. Now, another one of the highlights of Shogamish was the numerous terraces that were part of the site. And these were leveled out portions of land attached to and jutting out from other parts of the settlement. The largest of these was about 400 meters by 300 meters, and it kind of had like four small, like lifted peaks almost, at different parts of it. And this is believed to have some, you know, serve some type of ceremonial purposes. And sorry, my mom's dog kind of barked there. She heard a car. Stop. All during this period, Moore and Lucy. But anyway, essentially, all during this period, more and more Susian sites appear, and the region is kind of well on its way to becoming as urbanized as Mesopotamia. Though none of these other sites are as large as Shogamish, which at its height, around 5000 BC or so, occupied around 17 hectares of land. However, around 200 to 400 years or so later, some manner of disaster struck. Many Susian sites were abandoned, and a number of those were that were abandoned show layers of destructive fire. Shogamish is no different, and its large central building was burnt and has since been called the Burnt Citadel. Though Shogamish wasn't permanently abandoned and the culture itself didn't collapse, its wealth and production fell drastically, and its path to, you know, true urbanization was slowed, but it did continue. Now, new Susian sites were founded further east and north, closer to the Zagros foothills and deeper in the marshlands. And one of these new sites was Susa. And it was founded sometime between 4400 and 4200 BC. And it was a strong site because even after it was sacked sometime around 4200, people returned and the city bounced back. By 4000 BC, it had absorbed two smaller settlements and reached 18 hectares. So it had surpassed Chogamish, which still existed, but it never really regained its former heights. Now, Susa was, again, producing things similar to other Susian sites, but we also have a lot of evidence of it producing copper, and copper axes at that, and other tools. There is another important Susian site that was founded around this time to the southwest, and this is the city of Anshan. And like Susa, it will be an important city of the Elamite kingdom. And this will be kind of the focus of this area next season. Now, sadly, we probably won't ever know who or what caused the destructions at Chogamish and the other sites. We can make guesses, but unfortunately, a lot of the artifacts and things like that at Chogamish were destroyed during the Iranian Revolution, as well as during the Iran-Iraq War. Just people moving through the area caused some issues, as, you know, refugees essentially running from the conflict, armies moving through, also caused a lot of damage to that site. Now, Susa itself did not receive those a lot of damage. And a lot of the artifacts from there were taken to the Louvre in Paris because it was kind of a French operation excavating that site. Which, you know, generally I'm not necessarily a fan of, you know, outsiders taking artifacts, but at least they were saved, you know, destruction from the Iranian Revolutionary period as well as the Iran-Iraq War. So we do have examples of the individual, or, you know, the new pottery style that emerged in Susa itself. Now, again, we don't know what caused the destruction or who caused the destruction. There is thought that it may have been people from the neighboring area of Mesopotamia. We know at later periods, some of the early dynasties of Ur warred against the kingdom of Elam, or its, you know, precursors. We know that the first dynasty of Ur claims to have made Elam Semit, or the land that would become Elam Semit. But it's also possible that, you know, there was some type of domestic disturbances among the Susian sites themselves. There could have been some type of famine that caused, like, a lot of internal conflicts. It's also possible that peoples coming out of the, you know, out of the mountains disrupted the Susian sites, and once they arrived, you know, they kind of adopted a lot of the culture and integrated themselves. And that is something that happens also in the historical period. So we have examples at later times of both Mesopotamian and peoples coming from further inland in the Iranian interior coming in and throwing the region into kind of a mess, as it were. And sadly, again, a lot of evidence and artifacts were destroyed, and that has made it kind of difficult to determine what happened specifically. And I don't know that we'll ever know, unfortunately. Again, we do see, again, the rise of copper. This is probably an area that enters the Copper Age much earlier and, like, more fully than, you know, some of the neighboring sites we've talked about. And, in fact, copper is going to become so important in the region and so prestigious and kind of a status symbol, much like bronze does, that there's almost a delay in the adoption of bronze in this area. Copper artifacts remain a much larger portion of tools and things like that, even after bronze has kind of taken over in other areas. Now, this might be just due to a lack of tin or, other metals to alloy with the copper. But there is a pretty well-established school of thought that, copper here was kind of a point of pride, and there was going to be a slight delay. But that's all stuff that we'll have to focus on in the future. Now, there is one other smaller group to the north in the border regions that we'll need to talk about, but I am going to save that for next week's episode. And we'll talk about them, and then we'll move into the more Central Asian region, where we kind of also touched on a little bit the Jitun culture of Central Asia. And they're, again, neighbors of peoples along the southern Caspian coast. But I would like to thank everyone for joining me. Sorry this was delayed in getting out. Again, my travel schedule got moved up due to our office deciding to close early, and I had some technical issues. As you might be able to tell from a change in sound quality, this episode was recorded in a couple of parts, so there may not be as great of a sound quality as throughout. I hope it won't be too bad. I hope it won't be too noticeable. But I do want to thank everyone again for joining me this week. If you have any questions or feedback or constructive criticism, please feel free to let me know. You can reach me at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can contact me via direct message on X or Twitter, whichever you prefer to call it. You can also comment on the YouTube videos. And I do appreciate the support that the show's gotten on YouTube as much as it has gotten here on the various audio feeds. I hope everyone who celebrates has a good Christmas and a good Christmas Eve. And then, of course, a good New Year's coming up after that. And if you're not big on those type of celebrations, then thank you just listening. I hope you have a good week and day from whenever you're listening to this, regardless of your personal celebration rituals. I appreciate all the support, and I hope you'll continue to support the show throughout this period and into the coming new year. It really means a lot to me, and I appreciate you all, and I hope to see you on the next episode and next year and all the years after. But anyway, thank you all again. Have a good evening or day. Peace.